Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and at Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and Twitter maniac, Stephen Gordon.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing, man?
I'm super fantastic. How are you, Stephen?
I'm doing well also. I've had a lot of fun with Twitter here lately. I never got what was the big deal about Twitter. You know, I mean, you're limited to 140 characters, and so why not just blog everything? You know, I mean, there's no limits on blogging, but
right.
It turns out there is something to it, and so I kind of jumped in a big way, and I've enjoyed it the last couple of weeks.
Well, we're going to spend some time talking about what you've chosen to tweet, and we're going to talk a little bit about Twitter, what is it good for? In fact, before I settled on the name for tonight's show as Stephen Gordon's Stream of Consciousness, I almost called this this edition of Fast Forward Radio Twitter, what is it good for? But I thought, no, that's not that's not going to draw in the masses like putting your name in the title of the show. So we went that way. But yeah, I think it bears examining a little bit this whole Twitter phenomenon, and now we've got our own, you know, bona fide insider tweet man here to take us through it. Plus, you've generated, I mean, the first and foremost thing I could say it's good for is it's generated all kinds of wonderful content for The Speculist, and we're just borrowing from I shouldn't say borrowing. Yeah, let me use a marketing term, a business term, an MBA term here. We're leveraging content.
The content. That's right.
That's right. You know, first from your Twitter feed, then into the blog, and now into the podcast. So can a book deal be far behind, I guess?
Well, I'm holding out for the movie rights here. You know, we're gonna
exactly. Yeah, that would come next for sure. I mean, it's all happening. But before we get into that, let's just check in on life in general. How are things going? Any breaking news? Anything interesting to report?
Oh, not too much. Went this weekend, saw Toy Story 3 with the wife and kids, and I've got to tell you, Pixar is just—I mean, they can do no wrong. These guys are just crazy good with the movies that they're putting out. It seems like every single one has been a hit, at least in my mind, and obviously in the minds of many others as well. It was a real crowd pleaser. Toy Story 3 was, which is surprising. You'd think that it would sag by the third installment, but it did not.
Well, that is a franchise that's really held true, isn't it? I mean, I liked the first one a lot. The second one, I thought, was just a profoundly philosophical and sad movie. The little cowgirl singing about the girl who didn't want her anymore. Man, that movie really got to me. And now we're saying the third one came in strong too. So,
yeah.
Good for Pixar on carrying out the full franchise. And this is truly the end, or do you think there'll be any more?
It felt like the end of a trilogy. There's always room for more. But the thing is, Pixar has kind of resisted the temptation to do sequels. Am I remembering it correctly to say that Toy Story is the only one they've done sequels to? That's right.
I can't think of any others. And when you think about it, they've sandwiched four Shrek movies, I think, in between Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3. So.
Yeah.
You know, they've shown a lot more restraint on the Toy Story end than the Shrek end. Which, not to make a, you know, not to compare the Shrek movies disfavorably, I enjoyed those quite a bit too.
Yeah, and that, the last Shrek movie, which I saw with the kids a couple of weeks ago, was strong also. So I mean, much stronger than I thought than the third one. And then the second one as well. I thought it was the best one since the first one. So anyway, we're off to a great start to the summer. I think I've not seen a stinker yet. Iron Man 2 was good.
Yes.
I liked A-Team. I thought it was a lot of fun. Toy Story 3 was great. Prince of Persia was fun. I like it when it seems like Hollywood's got their act together for.
Another big movie summer, I think is the right way
exactly.
to say those words, right? We tracked that a couple years ago when we were having a incredibly awesome movie summer, and maybe we're on track to have another one this year. I've only seen, let's see, what have I seen? Iron Man 2 is really the only real summer movie I've seen, unless you count Robin Hood, which I did like. So,
yeah.
But... I'm gonna try to keep up. You know, I know the new Twilight's coming out. Presumably, for those who follow that franchise, that's probably the big thing happening this summer in the movies. So all you Twilight fans, good luck with that and enjoy. I guess.
I've resisted that franchise pretty well. I saw the first one basically kicking and screaming, and I've held off on seeing the second one. But it's just a matter of taste. I don't judge. That's just not my thing. So.
I don't judge either, but I would refer anyone who wants to get a basic idea of where I feel about Twilight to Google the following words: Craig Ferguson, YouTube, Twilight, and I think you'll find out everything you need to know. But I've probably said too much. Well, let's leap into this. We've got more material than we can possibly deal with this evening, because what we decided we would do tonight, I've titled this show Stephen Gordon's Stream of Consciousness, because that's what we've been treated to at the Speculist over the last couple of weeks, as Stephen has been publishing his tweets, republishing his Twitter feeds, or his feed individual Twitter entries, tweets I guess is the only word for that, as blog posts at the Speculist. So we've all gotten to enjoy them either by following him on Twitter or by reading about it in the Speculist. So let's just do a little context setting, Stephen. What pulled the switch for you? You woke up one morning and said, "You know what? I'm going to conquer Twitter."
Well, you know, the morning I woke up to do this was the morning of the H+. Okay, and
right.
So I said, "Well, how can I follow H+?" You know, the best, you know, I mean, and so I got on, the Humanity Plus website, and, I started listening to the stream. They filmed everything. It was great getting to watch basically the entire conference, every bit that I could, you know, every minute I could spare that weekend, I was there in front of that watching it. And, I just saw that there was a Twitter feed, and beyond that, it was, you know, there's a hash mark kind of deal where you can follow that particular subject. So anybody who is tweeting on the subject of the H+ conference can come up, you know, on your Twitter. So I said, hey, you know, I got to see this. So of course I signed up for my own account, and then once I started seeing these tweets come through that talking, you know, basically giving me running commentary on what was going on in the not just on camera, but out in the halls as well. I thought that was pretty cool. So I started tweeting my own impressions of the H+ conference, and I didn't stop, because then that was the same day you were coming in with your review of the Singularity Is Near movie
mm-hmm.
in Breckenridge. And so anyway, it just snowballed from there. So I just found that it was. The cool thing about Twitter is that it put it to you this way: by keeping everybody to 140 characters, puts a discipline in place so that you don't get bogged down on one story, unless you care to. So basically, you're seeing 140 characters is not much, but it's more than a title's worth. Okay, so basically, you can you can see what it is that they're excited about and bother to tweet, and then you can click through and read whatever story it is they're linking to. And so, I mean, you can scan so much more material than you could if you were, you know, trying to read through blogs. And that's I think the key strength to Twitter is that you can cover so much more subject wise than you would ordinarily. And then of course, you know, I then took that Twitter feed, my own, everything I tweeted on, and then threw it up on the Speculus, but with additional commentary. My thoughts on the tweets beyond 140 characters if I needed it. So that was the deal. That's what I've been doing.
Well, it's been quite a phenomenon. I guess it's been going on for 2 years, 3 years now. I'm not sure. It's been around for a couple years anyway, I think we can safely say. And it's quite a phenomenon in...
Not universally loved. One guy, you know, one person that we respect a lot and who's been on the show a couple of times, Michael Anisimov, basically tweeted, which I thought was hilarious. He tweeted, "Twitter sucks. You know, this medium is just not good enough." You know,
he has been doing a series of tweets taking down Twitter, which is awesome.
But of course, I didn't have to defend it. Ben Gertzel, another guest on this show. You know, basically saying, you know, saying Twitter sucks is like saying phone calls suck. You know, it's the medium is what you make it, and I agree with him on that. So,
well,
right.
In fact, you've jumped to one of my just to let the audience in on how we're doing the show tonight. Stephen and I have each selected four. Well, we were supposed to select four. I've actually got six. Tweets from the various ones that he's posted on the blog over the last couple of weeks, and we're each going to talk about one. And Stephen, you've actually just now pulled one from my list because I was going to talk about how Michael had started taking down Twitter, and Ben had come to its defense. And I really liked I liked the analogy to the phone call, and I think it all goes back to are you familiar with Sturgeon's Law?
Is that the one that talks about the power of a network? Is that the law?
No. Theodore Sturgeon, a science fiction writer, was at a, I believe, a fan event, science fiction, either fan event or writers conference, many years ago, and someone was confronting him with the degradation of the quality of published science fiction, and said to him, you know, 90% of the stories we see these days are crap. And Theodore Sturgeon responded with what has since become ensconced worldwide as Sturgeon's Law: 90% of everything is crap. And
yeah, that is absolutely the truth too. I mean,
you know, I mean, it's true about.
We remember the 10% and forget the crap, and that's why, you know, people say, I love old movies. Love, you know, old movies are great. You know, they really knew how to make movies back then. No. You know, we remember the 10% that were great and forget everything else. And
yeah,
so,
you know, you forget the ones that were crap. And the trick to Twitter is exactly what you said. It's it forces a discipline on the tweeter, not unlike the discipline that is forced upon one trying to compose a haiku. And in fact, there's this whole trend. I don't know if you've followed any of this. There's this whole like fad going on right now of people tweeting haikus, because that's a nice form to, you know, get it within 140 characters. So you've got a very limited canvas on which to paint an idea, to get an idea out there. And yes, you can put a completely superficial, completely pointless idea there. In fact, you can put many dozens of those up an hour, right, if you want to, and that's your Twitter feed. Or you can look for something interesting. You can look for a new perspective on the world. You can look for something exciting that's happening, or you can look for just something that captures your attention and that you think you'd like to share with others and put that up there. And, you know, even I fear a lot of people trying to do that are going to push quite a bit of crap out, that being the nature of how things work. But
Well, here's the deal with me. I'm following people that are interesting to me.
Right.
Is pretty much every person that's ever been a guest on Fast Forward Radio, I'm following if they've got a Twitter feed. And of course, their tweets tend to be a little higher quality, I would imagine, than the general population of tweets out there. Okay. And then, sometimes, if it's obvious that those people that I was following are following others. Now, I look at who they're following. And, so what you do is you get out there and you check out who everyone's following, and then you follow them for a while. And if they're pushing out crap, then what you do is you stop following them. And because you do have a limited amount of time to read through these tweets, and you don't want to have to be scanning, and if somebody's just constantly putting inane things in there, you kick them. Because, frankly, there's not enough time in the day for that when there's so much good out there that's interesting to get to. So,
I think the important thing is
that's the trick to Twitter, I think.
People are making serious use of Twitter. It's used in business. By day I work in the software industry, and Twitter is a very important part of the overall community of software developers, of software analysts, influencers, the press, marketing people like myself, the user community. There's a good deal of connectivity between blogs and Twitter, and to a lesser extent Facebook and some of the other social media sites. But Twitter in particular really seems to have captured the imagination of consultants, analysts, journalists. I was having dinner last week with a top software analyst for one of the big firms. If you started naming the top analyst firms, you would name them very quickly in your list, if not initially. He's one of their top guys, and the guy is a Twitter fiend. Okay, and he's got thousands upon thousands of followers. One of the things I was eager to do after I left dinner was to get back to my hotel room and fire up his feed and see if he mentioned that he'd had dinner with me. But the interesting thing he said was, I've written books. I've spent years researching books and, poured my heart and soul into bringing them to market and had them sell, 500 copies. Well, I can tweet tomorrow about, something that IBM might be doing, and 10,000 people know about it and are responding to it and are talking about it. So it's a really different way of reaching an audience. I think the immediacy of it for those who are able to use it effectively is something really profoundly different than any means of communication that people have had before. And I'm the first to admit that when I first heard about Twitter, when it was first brought up as like this, what is it? It's collecting places where people send their phone short messages. It sounded to me almost like a joke. It sounded like, well, that sounds, like the biggest waste of time ever. But I've seen it really roll itself out and become a real mover and shaker within, at least within the software business, and I'm sure it's true within a lot of other businesses as well. And I think, Stephen, as you're demonstrating now, it has a role to play in the world of those of us who are looking at the future.
Absolutely. Talking about it sounded like a joke. It's actually been parodied. We'll have to put this in the show notes. I forget if it was Comedy Central or who was parodying it by talking about a new service beyond Twitter that was basically, now we're down to 12 characters.
we actually had a video up on that, on a Friday video. About a year ago, it was Flutter, right? And
it was Flutter, yeah. And people were trying to, get some meaning out of, a ridiculous number of characters. That was pretty.
Yeah, cool. that was great. If Twitter is microblogging, Flutter is nanoblogging, right? That was great. that was awesome. Okay, so let's push on. We've got a lot of topics to get to because what we're doing tonight is we're reading through Stephen's Twitter feed, and we're discussing random various topics that he's brought up. And our first one was the value of Twitter. Now, I'm going to do one, even though you did one of mine just now, just so I get, first dibs on one of these.
Yeah, go for it.
How about this story that the moon has 100 times more water than was previously thought? This was linked a story on space.com, and it says the moon's interior may harbor 100 times more water than previous estimates, according to a new study that took a fresh look at samples of moon rocks collected by Apollo astronauts nearly 40 years ago. The researchers determined that the lunar water likely originated early in the moon's formation history, suggesting that it is, in fact, native to the moon. So, very interesting. There's a lot of water on the moon, a lot more than we ever thought, and a good deal of it is trapped in rocks or trapped under the surface of the moon, but there also has been ice discovered on the surface of the moon. So this is a profoundly important development in terms of the exploration and settlement of the nearby solar system. And I'll tell you why. If you've ever read Robert Zubrin's book on his Mars Direct program, The Case for Mars, he makes a very good case for if we're going to move into space, if we're going to settle in space, our first stop has got to be Mars. Now, Mars is way out there. I mean, relatively, for other planets, it's the closest next planet, I suppose, or Venus, depending on when and where. But certainly the closest one that's not an oven, right?
Exactly.
But, you know, even when it's really close, it's 30 million miles away. The moon is 250,000 miles away. But according to Zubrin in his book, the moon's not an option. We can't go to the moon. Why? Well, you know, it just lacks the resources. You know, there's no water up there, for one thing. Well, now we're coming to find that, yeah, actually, there is a lot of water on the moon. And when you start thinking about a wet moon, I mean, the word wet is probably a little bit out of line, but a moon that could have water reclaimed on it, a moon with sufficient quantities of water that you could support a settlement there, then you've got a very accessible place to start settling the solar system. And we could learn an awful lot about how to build a space settlement and how to live on another planet and, you know, how to mine for resources and all the things that we need to learn much closer to Earth than we would have to by going to Mars. And I think that water on the moon can be the deal maker that allows that to happen. The other big thing I think that allows that to happen is if we figure out how to mine, how to extract, and what to do with the helium-3 that's up there. Because at that point, you've got the moon as not only an attractive place to settle, but it's a great source of fuel for spacecraft that could then be built to travel to other planets or ultimately anywhere you want to go in the universe. So the moon kind of becomes our outpost. It becomes kind of our space station and a great little stepping off point for the rest of the universe. And that's what I extrapolate from this from this news that the moon has more water on it. What do you think?
Absolutely. I saw another story basically taking the same facts and from that they were able to glean, well, this, how much water is this? Well, it's about Lake Michigan is what we're talking about. It's a lot of water. That's a lot of water on the moon. And so with that, of course, you can get oxygen by extracting the oxygen from the water. Of course, then there would be a hydrogen that could be used as fuel. Helium-3, of course, is a totally different resource on the moon, but it's the ultimate and the best fusion fuel that theoretically could exist. And so that's with what we understand of from science now, it is the best fuel for a fusion reactor. And so And that is in great abundance on the moon and hardly present at all on the Earth. So basically, the moon is not this big, you know, hunk of rock sitting up there with of no value to us. It turns out that you know it's going to be huge in our settlement of the solar system. You know, and once we get there, let's say you're on the moon. How hard is it going to be to move from the moon then to Mars? Well, a whole lot easier you could take off from the moon a whole lot easier and break its gravity well a whole lot easier than you could the Earth. And so
absolutely,
it is an ideal in many ways base for the settlement of the solar system. So
It's great because it's got some gravity, but not a lot of gravity. You know, it's got gravity, so you can live there, and you're not gonna just completely deteriorate. And also, you know, you can have all the stability of fixed permanent settlements and industry and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, yeah, getting a rocket out of the moon or building a space elevator on the moon will be a much easier project. In fact, it'd be interesting if we were doing one of those what's going to happen first programs tonight. It just occurred to me, which do you think we'll have first, a lunar space elevator or an earthbound space elevator? But we'll have to leave that. That'll be a topic for another night. Let's move on. We got lots more tweets. You take one now.
All right. Okay. Let's see. What do I want to do here? Basically, in my mind, as I was looking at the tweets, I was saying, okay, this is news from the last month or so. What, in order of importance, how important are these things that are occurring? Can you compare them, say, to the landing of a man on the moon? You know, have we in the last couple of months, has anything as important as landing on the moon happened? And the surprising answer is yes, about three times.
I want to hear the list. What are the three things that have happened in the last month that are as big as man landing on the moon?
Craig Venter, synthetic life. Okay, he built from raw chemicals. Put together DNA, put it inside of an empty cell casing, and boom, it's alive and reproducing. That is profound. That is a profound moment in science. And
it is almost unbelievably huge, that story.
Yes.
And to think that the nonplussed reaction, I mean, the completely unimpressed reaction that the world has had to that is pretty astounding, isn't it?
I mean, it's as if we, I don't know. It's amazing how low key the response has been to it. I guess everybody's distracted by the leaking oil in the Gulf or something. But it's,
granted. But come on,
this is kind of a big deal, guys.
Synthetic life, yeah.
Yeah, and so that yes. That's
okay, I'll give you that one. That one's bigger than that. I agree. It's at least tied with going to the moon. What else?
Okay. How about a computer system that can compete with Jeopardy contestants and win 4 out of 5 times in general knowledge? You ask it general knowledge questions and it beats humans 4 out of 5 times.
Now my question is: Can it really unwind those Jeopardy answers the way they're phrased? Because those are complicated.
It answers in questions. Yeah.
If you've ever watched Jeopardy, one of the tricky things is you don't know exactly what they're getting at sometimes, so you get right to the very end, right? It's like, she was the blah, 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 you know, and you think the answer is going to be her name,
Madonna.
But actually
exactly.
The answer is the name of the movie she was in or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the system does it and wins 4 out of 5 times against, the best Jeopardy players that they can put in front of it. To me, that's amazing. Now, that's not passing the Turing test. You know, having a conversation is still probably beyond this computer. But still, I think this is a remarkable moment in artificial general intelligence. I mean, that's basically a field that it's just been a theoretical field for 30 years, artificial general intelligence. All we've had so far is just artificial intelligence in very limited fields like winning in chess and things like that. This is general knowledge, and I find that remarkable. And so, I put that up there with the landing of man on the moon, even though it's something as silly as winning in Jeopardy. That's kind of a big deal.
No, that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, if a computer was good at, like, Wheel of Fortune, right? That's where we expect them to be. But
yeah, exactly.
think of the leap between those two games. And not to say anything bad about, you know, the people on Wheel of Fortune or anything like that, but I'm just, you know, it's one thing to fill in the blanks and figure out a word or a phrase, and it's something else entirely to be given a phrase, to unpack that phrase, and then respond with
the question.
Yeah, the correct question that's the answer to. Yeah, that's huge. Okay, I don't know. I'm such a loyal Apollo guy. I'm not sure if I'm going to give that one bigger than the. If it won 5 out of 6 times, maybe, but 4 out of 5, no. Okay, it's close. It's close.
Okay,
so you got one. You got one more though.
Okay. How about we don't need to worry about Moore's Law playing out here in the next year or two.
Okay. Tell me more.
Okay. The reason is, here's the problem with silicon. Integrated circuits are reaching the theoretical maximum of what can be done with silicon, and will be in the next just few years. We're talking the next 5 years. It'll reach a point where we won't be able to make silicon, basically we're reaching a point of atomic precision where we can't go any lower with that. So here comes graphene to the rescue. Obviously there are other things that perhaps could come to the rescue at some point, quantum computers and things like this, but that might be a few more years down the road.
Right.
Graphene is ready now, basically, or will be shortly, and they're talking in making a transistor and then an integrated circuit with graphene. Turns out graphene is 10 times faster than silicon.
Wow!
And so there you go. There, you know, perhaps Moore's Law still got a little more life in him. Although, to be fair to Gordon Moore, he was talking about specifically about silicon. So, you know, but the thing is, when silicon plays out, it looks like we'll have something that'll be stepping right on up into place and continue the improvement of computer technology.
Okay, I'm going to give you 2 out of 3 on your 3. Okay,
okay.
The only reason I'm not going to say that the Moore's Law extending beyond the next couple of years, beyond this silicon substrate, is as big as the moon landing is just because that one's not a big surprise to me, because Kurzweil had already reassured us in The Singularity Is Near that a new substrate would kick in no matter what, and that it was not going to run out. So, and also
I'm sure he's pleased to be right. So
yeah, of course, as always, and he'll mention that one, you know, no doubt.
Exactly.
See, I told you. That's the great thing about Kurzweil. He never does that.
Listening to me eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. He never takes that time.
I didn't get groupies for nothing. You know,
That's what you got. That's what you have to admire about the man, is he never takes that tone. Because you know I would. I would. That would be my first half hour, just berating people. If you would just listen to me when I talk about the future, that's how I would start. But not Ray. Okay, so yeah, I'm going to give you 2 out of 3, and I agree that third is potentially the biggest of all. Simply because we need Moore's Law to keep going to get us to where we're going. And speaking of that, why don't I piggyback off that one to talk about the exponential curves for the Human Genome Project. And essentially in your tweet, and I don't have the tweet in front of me, unfortunately, I don't have the link story, but that has to do not just with the Human Genome Project, but with remind me what the original tweet on that one was.
Let's see. Exponential development.
Yeah, that's the one.
Actually, I talked about exponential development in a couple of tweets, and one of them was the exponential development of being able to track down exoplanets.
No, nope, not that one.
That's not this, the one, huh?
No, this is the one about the. Here, I'll find it.
I apologize, but anyway.
Well, it's okay. You do so many. How are you gonna, you know? See, this is. Michael Anisimov is listening and laughing. See? This is what I'm trying to tell you about Twitter.
This is why Twitter sucks. While you're doing that, I want to hit another one I thought was a lot of fun. Power from thin air. Basically, wouldn't it be cool if we didn't have to plug in our iPhones and laptops anymore? Well,
right.
Nokia, is it Nokia? let's see here. Yeah, I believe it is. It's Nokia is working on a system where basically you can power your laptop and your cell phone from radio waves. Basically, the local radio station will be powering your devices. And I mean, and the fun thing is that you're not even taking anything away from them. You're not, you know, it's this power is already being expended all around you. You're just taking advantage of a resource that's there that has not been used up till now. And so, there you go. This continues the ability of us to unplug and be able to compute anywhere. So I think that's pretty fun.
That's very cool. To me, that one is big because that implies a future in which it really doesn't matter what your battery life is in your mobile phone, right?
Right.
As long as you're getting a signal, you can get power. Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you just you know.
And not just your mobile phone, but your iPod, your iPad. What about your electric car? How much can they transmit, really?
Right now, the theoretical maximum is like 50 megahertz, which is enough to charge a phone and a laptop, but not anything close to what you would need to charge a car. My thought is, though, what if you're charging from the universe's background noise or something like that? I mean, there's lots of radio waves going on in the cosmos that if you could perhaps pick up on, you wouldn't even need a transmitting station to be leeching off of. You could, you know, basically let the power of the universe juice up your laptop, your car, or whatever.
Let me make sure I understand. I was understanding that there's power starting someplace and it's being transmitted by radio waves, kind of like instead of the cable. But you're saying that the energy is just being kind of sucked out of the environment somehow?
Exactly. Pretty cool,
well,
huh?
Yeah, that's extremely cool.
Yeah.
I have to read up more on that. I'm dumbfounded. That's so cool. That's up there with the moon thing. If they can, keep looking for the background energy, and eventually you go for the zero point energy, right? The
exactly. If it's already there, why not take advantage of it? So
yeah, let's tap into that.
Yeah.
And we know it's possible because the ancients did it in Stargate.
That's right. Well,
Atlantis.
You know, they,
yeah.
In all seriousness, this is not new. Tesla was doing it. That's what he was with that big tower that he had. That's what he was attempting to do, was wireless transmission of power. And the problem with that was that how do you meter that? If you're the company that's running the tower that's sending out the electricity for people to power their homes and things like that, well, how do you get paid for that? Well, here this is. You know, this is leeching off of much smaller sources. You know, your local radio station puts out enough power to charge your cell phone, but not run your washing machine and your refrigerator. And so, you know, this is just this is basically just ambient power that's out there for the taking, and it doesn't even hurt their radio signal for you to do so. So, that's pretty cool. So,
very cool. And you know, the Tesla angle just makes it all the cooler. Any vindication for Tesla, of course, is a good thing. So, I found the one I was looking for, and you're right. The tweet was, technology benefits on an exponential curve. We shouldn't judge the Human Genome Project results before the elbow in the curve. And you'd published a little blurb from that story. Yes, it's been 10 years since we sequenced the human genome, and no, we haven't cured cancer, obesity, or aging yet. Exponential trends have a way of surprising us, making us think that the world changed overnight. And I think this is so potentially huge.
We talk
about sequencing the genome like that was the big accomplishment. Of course, it is a big accomplishment. But,
yeah.
You know, the real task is starting to pull the value out of that. And once that really kicks in, it's going to, if you pardon the expression, transform the world.
This was a response to all these stories that basically came out it's been 10 years since the genome was unraveled, and we, you know, all I got was this darn T-shirt, you know.
Right.
I mean, I got nothing. We've gotten nothing out of this multi-billion-dollar project. I guess it was for nothing. Well, I think it's going to be fun to watch these guys eat their words in the next few years, because the development of the technologies that are coming out of that, it's already an exponential trend. It's just that it's so early in the exponential trend that we can't. It's really below the radar at this moment, but it's not going to stay there for long. I feel like we're getting to the elbow of the curve very soon, next year or two. I would guess.
I think we will too. I think we'll see tremendously radical changes occurring. But don't hold your breath waiting for people to eat their words. Okay, unfortunately, people kind of tend to roll with things, and. The interesting thing about it is I bet we'll be doing a show here in 3, 4, 5 years talking about some massive medical breakthrough that has occurred thanks to our understanding that was brought about through sequencing the genome, and the response to it will be along the same lines of synthesizing life.
Yeah, ho-hum.
Well, and that in itself,
never,
I think...
And we never have to die. Oh, well.
It is indicative of the fact that we live in exponential times. After you hear so many amazing things, we've talked about this before, it's hard to continue to be amazed. And one of the reasons we do this program is to help remind people how amazing all of this stuff really is. And we should be completely awestruck by the times we're living in and the times we're moving into, because this is one example, right? The genome being mapped is one thing that's going to kick in. You know, that research that led to the computer playing Jeopardy, man, that's going to have some serious applications. I mean, beyond just entertainment. There are huge potential applications for a computer program that can behave in that way, and it gets us a lot closer to what John Smart calls the conversational user interface. We live in a world where we're just talking to machines, and where virtually anything that goes wrong with our bodies is mappable and curable. Man, that sounds like some kind of crazy utopian, wacky science fiction future, and probably not that far off. Not that far off at all.
Very cool. Very cool. So yeah.
All right. What's next?
Yeah, you see why I have trouble picking just four things. I mean, so much cool stuff happening.
Absolutely. It's really exciting to lay out a bunch of, you know, it's always fun to do these kind of grab bag shows anyway, but it's really fun to get into your head, Stephen, and see what
that's a dangerous place to be.
what are the things that that caught your attention and that you wanted to share, and you picked some good stuff.
Appreciate it. Well, here's another one. Here's a fun one. A company called Lightbridge has come out with a plan for making nuclear reactors that are powered by thorium, and the whole point was, hey, we can encourage the world to switch to thorium reactors, which produces no weapons grade materials at all, and it's completely safe, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, guess what? The world just sort of went, nah, no thanks. Well, we want our weapons grade materials, and so they've gotten nowhere with that idea. But the cool thing about this was in the development of a thorium nuclear reaction, and I'm talking fission now. This is good old-fashioned fission. We're not talking fusion, okay? In the development of their thorium reactor, they invented a component that, in order to make it work at all, was necessary in a thorium reactor, but now it turns out it can be moved into other nuclear reactors that are powered by uranium or plutonium or whatever, that will increase the efficiency of these reactors by 30%.
Hmm.
And it does so by making the reactors burn hotter, thereby producing more electricity. And by burning hotter, guess what else happens? A whole lot less atomic or radioactive waste is produced at the end of the run. Burns it up.
That's your 30% boost, right? Your 30% energy is all the stuff that would have become
waste.
The waste
that, it been, that you would have had to store is actually being
right.
used now in the reactor to generate more power. And so that's kind of a big deal. And so congratulations to Lightbridge. You produced something that no one in the world wanted until they realized, hey, we can actually use this in the reactors we already have. So
In the chat room, MSD calls this a nitrous injector for a fission reactor. That's the basic idea, right? I mean, it's a turbo accelerator for nuclear reactors. What a great idea. And they're in production with this now. Is this being deployed anywhere?
We need to put the link in the chat room, but let's see. I think that may actually be beyond the story how far they're into it. If Lightbridge's idea for metal uranium fuel works in conventional reactors, it could be a big contribution to the nuclear energy, given that the thorium reactor is an idea that won't go away but doesn't seem to be coming to fruition either. So basically, it's like, Lightbridge is going, we certainly hope the world will take this on, because you pretty much poo-pooed on our last great idea. And for the sake of the company, please adopt this technology. But yes, that's
Think about all the power in the world that's generated through nuclear fission reactors, and you say, okay, now we can add 30% to that, and we don't have to build additional power plants to get there. I mean, we should be building more fission power plants anyway, but without even doing that, we can have 30% more energy. That's a good deal right there. That is a darn good deal.
And
go ahead.
Store at Yucca Mountain when it's all done. So,
absolutely. The bottom line is we shouldn't be storing stuff in Yucca Mountain anyway. We should be using breeder reactors to turn that stuff back into fuel and just keep cycling it through until it's all gone. But that's probably a discussion for another day. You know what? I'm running rapidly out of topics. I've been so pure about trying to move quickly through them. Now I'm going to take a really short one that I enjoyed. This was somebody's tweet on the I don't even think that this originated with you. You were commenting on it, but it was a note for the H+ Summit, and it said H+ Summit : live long and prosper. And your comment was that's knowing your audience when you
that is the title of the next H+ Summit that's coming. What is this fall or this winter?
It's November 5th, 6th, and 7th in LA.
Yeah, it's live long and prosper, and I believe that the primary subject, obviously, with this is going to be life extension, and that's a pretty good title for the summit.
Well, that it occurred to me after I read that. I'm glad to see the H+ folks adopting the old Vulcan greeting, farewell or well wish, Vulcan aloha, pretty much, I guess.
Hello, goodbye, everything.
Yeah, it's got a lot of applications.
Shalom.
Yeah, it's kind of the Vulcan shalom. It occurred to me that the Vulcans were most of the way to sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. They just left out the sexy, right?
I guess
right?
so.
Live long and prosper. If you include prosper both the billionaire part and the superpower part, they had the immortal part and the
give us sexy with the Enterprise series, I think. I tried to bring that back in. But anyway.
Oh, well, for sure. Yeah, I thought they did pretty well with that, too. But I think that it's just interesting that those notions that, because when I trotted out sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, I thought, hey, that's a pretty radical new idea. And actually, it's not that new at all. That's really a traditional futurist notion, right, is that's where we're headed. I think it's cool that the H+ Summit has adopted that. And I'm going to really try to make that one. November 5th, 6th, and 7th in LA. That's not that long away, but I'm going to see if I can possibly make it to that one. That sounds like a fun event, and they probably need someone there to come.
We need
talk
boots
about.
On the ground at these summits. We really do. It was great to hear from George George Dvorsky after the summit last week.
Well, and we had Leslie on the ground, so that was good too. I mean, we actually did have a person on the scene, which was which was cool, and we need to keep that going.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
And of course, we do need you blogging the live feeds because you do that. You do that quite well. Okay. So what do you got next?
Carbon nanotubes and lithium batteries. Okay, here's the deal. We need batteries. The batteries are going to be a huge part of the future, it appears. You know, we want to be unplugged in our lives. Many things require it, including cars and computers and cell phones and everything else. But the problem is, obviously, we need lots of power, and we want to be able to use it over a long period of time. And it's always been a problem that with batteries, by comparison to say a gallon of gasoline, the weight of a battery to take you as far as a gallon of gasoline was basically you know 10 times the weight of a gallon of gas.
Right.
So, anyway, MIT. Researchers at MIT now have a theoretical a model for building the next generation of lithium batteries using carbon nanotubes. And guess what? If their math holds, these batteries will be 10 times that will have 10 times the storage.
Wow.
Of the present best batteries. And so, all of a sudden, electrical vehicles begin to look like something that maybe we can do that'll be every bit as good as in both range and performance as our gasoline powered cars. That to me is that's a big deal.
That's huge.
So, yeah.
So it's lithium batteries using carbon nanotube technology. Just talk us through that briefly. How are the carbon nanotubes making a difference here in these batteries?
Let's see here. Produce powerful new electrode material, you don't have to use. The whole battery doesn't have to be infused with carbon nanotubes. Apparently, just one electrode. The team used a layer by layer fabrication method in which a base material is alternatively dipped in solutions containing carbon nanotubes that have been treated with simple organic compounds that give them either a positive or a negative net charge. When these layers are alternated on the surface, they bond tightly together because of the complementary charges, making a stable and durable film. Then bang. I mean, then that apparently because of that, and we're talking, when you lay something down with atomic precision, all of a sudden there's more places to put power to store electrons. I think that's a big part of it.
Right.
And
I'm sorry, who's doing this research?
MIT.
MIT. You know who's got to be, if not funding this, all over this research is Tesla Automobile Company.
Oh yeah, they ought to be.
Right, because I mean they're powering these little sports cars using essentially a bank of laptop batteries, right? If you can have the same amount of power coming from a much lighter source, you've got a much longer range vehicle, much more effective vehicle, et cetera. And we got a great discussion going on in the chat room about what we need to have happen once you've got that super powerful battery is the ability to pull into the gas station, the battery station in this case, and just swap it out. They should all be universally interchangeable, so you don't have to wait. You just show up there and you get a freshly charged battery because you've traded the one that you have. That or we need quick charge technology, because one of the real deal breakers on electric cars is, what do you do with this need to this long wait that you have to go through in order to get the battery recharged? Now, does nanotechnology address that? I'm not asking. That's a rhetorical question, but I wonder if anyone's looking into finding a way for nanotechnology to make like not only a more powerful battery but a more quickly charging battery.
I think the guys in the chat room have it right. I think some sort of quick swap system is the way to go. I mean, just basically have you pull into the gas station and pull over something similar to the pit where you get your oil changed. And, a robot just disconnects the battery pack underneath your car, replaces it with a new battery pack, and you're zooming away probably in less time than it would take to fill up the car with gas. That's the way
so
to
in
go.
A sense, you don't really own a battery. You own the right to have a battery in your car, pretty much, right?
That's right.
And and you're paying each time for the transaction cost of swapping it out or something like that.
Plus the power that's being put into the battery, and which by the way is so much cheaper. The energy necessary to travel a mile is like the equivalent. Put it this way, it's like a 30-cent gallon of gasoline.
Wow.
Is the electricity is necessary to take you as far as a gallon of gas would. The only problem has been the weight of the batteries and not getting sufficient range out of these vehicles because, you know, you pretty much need a 1,000 pounds of battery. So that's using these this carbon nanotube method is, that's pretty cool too, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, it gives us a lot to look forward to, not only that story, but all of your tweets. And did you have one more that you want to do? Or actually, it's my turn. I think I get to have the last word.
Why don't you give us the last word.
Okay. So the last word is actually, you've given us all this great stuff looking forward, but I think my favorite one has got to be this look into an alternate past, the alternate 1977. And this link from Boing Boing, and it was basically the link is up on the Speculist. We'll include it in the show notes as well. But here's a picture of what some of our cherished modern 2010 technology would have looked like had someone from our era gone back to the year 1977 and deployed it. And it's a wonderful sight because not only does it capture the feel of technology at that time, but it really captures the look and feel of advertisements for consumer electronics at that time. I look at those, and those look like real ads for real products. I mean, they're not. There was no such thing as an iPod in 1977. But by golly, if there had been, that's exactly what that thing would have looked like, and that's what the ad for it would have looked like too. It's a great view into a world that never was, and I guess fortunately, huh? If you take computer technology and you put it back in the Victorian era, that's steampunk. What would this be? This would be like disco punk or something like that, right?
Groovy punk or something. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, enjoyed that, Stephen.
I don't know.
And all of your tweets, just great stuff. Keep up the good work on that. That is really fun following you on Twitter. And I will mention that we're looking for a tighter way to integrate your tweets into the blog. So hopefully we'll have some news on that soon. So what's our music this evening?
The music is, the song is I Have Seen the Future, and the artist is Id Guinness.
Id Guinness, like the beer?
That's right.
Id Guinness sings I've Seen the Future. Well, thanks, Stephen, for putting that together and providing all of our content for the program this evening. Thanks to our friends in the chat room for a very lively chat, and to everyone listening to us live and listening to us via recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back, believe it or not, at the normal time once again next week. And until then, live to see it. Yeah.